Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, state pension top-ups are in dire need of an overhaul, says our somewhat overworked Tanya. So is a new online service being launched in the spring the answer? Simon explains what on earth's going on in the bond market. The premium bond gift worth almost £100 in today's money when it was given is worth next to nothing now. We'll discuss that. And we do love a neighbourly dispute. This time, cameras in the back garden. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, a new online service for buying state pension top-ups will be launched by the spring. It comes after a deluge of complaints that the current system is confusing and takes too long to process payments. Now, buying top-ups can give a generous boost to your retirement income if you buy the correct years on your record. But the system is run jointly by the Department for Work and Pensions and HMRC. So horror of horrors, you have to currently deal with both of them. Tanya, I can't imagine anything worse. Just to let the dear listeners into a little secret, we were talking about this before we went live on air, Tanya, and how many complaints you are getting at the moment, which is why I say you're somewhat overworked, because this is such a big issue at the moment. Before we get into the fact that you're having to do the government's work for them, what are state pension top-ups? Why would you buy them? How does the system work? Go.
They do give a good boost to your state pension, and they fill gaps in your record, basically, either part years or full years that you haven't earned towards your state pension.
Why might you have those? Is it perhaps children?
Anyone could have gaps in their record for lots of different reasons. You either didn't work for a couple of years, you might have earned credits in some other ways, for instance, while you claimed child benefit or while you were, for instance, a carer. So it's always worth checking that you've got all the credits applied before you then start trying to buy top-ups. But a lot of people have got varied records, and it is a really useful way of getting your state pension up to the maximum you can. Last year it went up by 10%. This coming year, well, it's not yet confirmed, but it might well be an 8.5% rise. The price has been frozen along with the deadline for this special deal where you can actually go back 16 years, well, more than that, really, to 2006 in terms of filling gaps. And you get your money back quite quickly. The headline price is about £820, and it can be less depending if it's a part year or so on. Once you've got that in the bag, then, you know, you can look forward to a better off retirement. And at the moment, people who are nearing retirement age really want to do that because they're aware of the cost of living crisis. They know that they might be a bit stretched. And having that guaranteed income, the good thing about the state pension is it's guaranteed until you die, like a old style final salary pension. And that is why getting your state pension up to scratch is so valuable.
So walk me through the old system. I mean, how did it work? How would you identify if you had any gaps? How could you fill them? What was so wrong with it? Why on earth do you have to go through two government departments? Ugh.
Well, the old system is the current system.
Oh, well, quite. The current system, then. I'm so optimistic. I'm praying for this new one. Or should I be?
Well, it's been the case for years that our readers constantly send us emails saying, I'm completely baffled. I don't know where to start with top-ups. And that's because some years will count towards boosting your state pension and others won't. And it's not obvious because there was an important rule change in 2016. And it really, there's no hard and fast rules. It depends on your own, you know, record and whether you were contracted out. So basically, you need to find out. And a lot of people make innocent errors with it. Some years ago, we were in a big tussle with HMRC because people were making errors that were no fault of their own, really, because the system was so confusing. And HMRC was refusing to give anyone refunds. And we did actually force them to back down on that, thank goodness. And they do issue refunds now, although it might take a while. But their stance now is you have to check with the DWP, or you're so strongly recommended to check with the DWP that it's almost considered negligent if you don't. But you have to get through to them. And there's been this big rush because of the special concession that I was talking about. The deadline was back in April, then it got extended to July. Now it's put back till 2025. So at least the pressure of meeting that deadline is off. But there was a huge rush of people doing this. And so getting through to the DWP to check your individual situation and know which years to buy that were worth buying was really, really hard. And you also, to do this properly, need to get a reference number from HMRC. I mean, you can send a check, but you can also do a bank transfer using the reference number. And the phone lines there were, you know, people tell us it takes ages to get through to HMRC as well. Once all that is in place, the trouble is, because of this backlog, you then have to wait. You get no receipt, no acknowledgement. Then you have to wait for HMRC to update your national insurance record. And then after that, you have to wait for the DWP to recalculate your state pension, you know, all your payments if you're already over state pension age. So at the end of that long process, you can see how many points there are where you can get stuck. And a lot of people we've really had so many emails from people who are just desperately worried about all the money that they've handed over to the government, and they just don't know where it's gone, and it takes months. And what is really frustrating is when they ring up, they don't get any actual help. Somebody I'll answer the phone eventually if they're lucky, if they don't get cut off beforehand. But people just take a message, really, and their problem doesn't get sorted. And so they feel that they're wasting their time, but they've got literally no other way to try and track down their money. And huge sums can be involved if you fill up a lot of years. The case we covered the other week, it was £11,500 because somebody had bought 14 years. That is on the high side, I've got to say. But if you don't hear about a large sum of money like that going missing, you're going to have sleepless nights over it. You can go to your MP. Obviously, people write to us, and we have getting an increasing number of desperate emails from people. But it is a really good idea to go to your MP. We can't help everybody, unfortunately. If you have written into us and you're listening to this, my apologies in advance, because we don't have the resources to sort out every single case. Even if you live overseas and you don't have an MP, you can contact the MP in the last constituency you lived in. I mean, obviously, it's going to vary as to how much help they're going to give you, but my understanding is that MPs do help people in that situation. They do help expats. So that is another option. You can wait it out and cross your fingers. But the thing that really worries people is that they don't know whether they're in a queue or the money has been lost. And we have heard from people who have been literally trying for years to find out what's happened to their top-ups money. I haven't investigated those stories yet, so I don't want to jump the gun and say, okay, this was definitely the government's fault. They've definitely lost the money, because until we've investigated, we don't know the true picture. But we have got cases that go back at least to 2020, and which it may turn out that the money's been lost all that time.
Dear, oh dear. So the government have proposed a new system that's being built at the moment. Is it going to answer all the issues that we have at the moment? And if not, Tanya, I know in your article you've proposed how to fix the system for good. But firstly, this new service.
It's difficult to say. Obviously, if there's going to be a website where you can input your details and it will tell you without having to ring up which years are going to be worth filling up automatically, that is going to be really good. If you can then pay on the spot, that will also be really good. If it's, you know, like doing a transaction on Amazon, then obviously that's going to be a lot easier. But we haven't seen this website yet. They're apparently testing it at the moment, and they've said that it will be by the end of the financial year, which is next spring, that it's launched. We'll have to see. I mean, I'm sure that our readers will write in and tell us whether it works or not pretty quickly. It's too difficult to say whether it'll work. You've got to remember there's still going to be two different separate departments standing behind it who are still presumably going to be updating NI records and recalculating estate pensions respectively. And no matter how good the website is, if what's going on behind the scenes isn't working smoothly, or if there are long delays, then the great website sitting at the front of it all might just look like a, you know, a shiny shop front, but the same situation will be continuing behind it.
So your proposition?
Well, I'm not an expert on administration. I'm a journalist. I'm a pensions and investment journalist. This is not my area of expertise. But I have sat for many, many years going through all the emails from readers. And the constant complaint is having to shuttle back and forth between departments and not knowing which one they're meant to be dealing with. I mean, I explained, didn't I, at the beginning about who's responsible for what. But the average person doesn't know that. They don't know which government department is updating the NI record and which bit is doing the sums on the state pension. And why should they, frankly? It's not their job to know this kind of thing and know which number to ring at any particular time at any point in the process. I've come to the conclusion that having two departments is a really bad situation. Presumably neither one of them would want to relinquish the responsibility. HMRC looks after the tax system and the money, and it probably does not want to give that to the DWP. And maybe there is good reasons why. But I don't understand why there can't be a joint department set up where all the teams from both departments working on this. They might still officially be HMRC or DWP, but they all work under one boss in one department, which is dedicated to running the top-up system efficiently, a unit, if you like, not a new government department, a department within them, which does things jointly. I also think because there's so many historical problems with individual cases, which they come to us and these problems look intractable, but if you've got some decent people behind the scenes, you could actually get them resolved. And I really think they need to do a sweep of these older cases. However hard they might look, they're cases of hardship lying in behind some of them. And everyone deserves to get their cases resolved. It's a really, really bad sign when a department is so overwhelmed that it looks like they just do the easy new cases coming in, and they put everybody else who has got where it's even slightly complicated in a too hard to fix pile. That's a truly bad sign. When people give an organisation or a company money, they ought to be able to handle the processing of that money. I mean, that seems to be, you know, one of the most basic things. If someone is trying to give you money, that you handle that effectively and competently.
Simon, thank you for sitting there so patiently. What are your views on this?
Well, whenever we talk about pension top-ups, it always seems to be something, a word that you can put together, and the second word is show. Put your own word in front of that and decide what it could be. It could be could of course be a horror show, couldn't it?
You know, that was exactly what I was thinking, Simon.
It's frustrating that this has been going on for so long. It's even more frustrating if you're one of the people who has paid thousands of pounds to top up your pension because you know that you need to boost it in retirement and then mysteriously don't know where your money's gone and whether you're getting anything for it. And you might expect that kind of thing with a shonky company. You don't expect it when you're dealing with the government. And they don't tend to operate in this way when they want money off you. When it comes to paying your tax bill, you can't behave in this way towards the government. They don't go for that. They'll start fining you. You can't start fining them because they haven't sorted out your top-ups. Tanya has dealt with so many cases. Steve Webb has dealt with so many cases for us. We put so much pressure on them. They extended this deadline, made a bit of a fanfare about that, when actually it was because they were making such a hash of what they were meant to be doing. Yet this still hasn't been properly sorted. And you get this vague promise of jam tomorrow, this system that might be sorted in the future, which doesn't really help. And I think it's very easy to listen to this and think, well, this doesn't affect me because I'm nowhere near my state pension. And I'll probably have enough years when I get there and I'm young and I don't need to worry about these things. But actually it does affect you because ultimately you A, need the system to be functioning properly. B, you might need to do something like this in years to come. And C, it will probably be affecting somebody that you might know. It will affect maybe your parents' generation or your relatives or the people that you work with and so on. And it's just not acceptable to have a system like this linked to something as important as the state pension. The state pension is something that we hold up to be so important that we have created the triple lock for it. Yet when it comes to the other end of it, the government can't run the bit where people are trying to top up their pension properly. And it needs sorting out. And we're going to keep putting the pressure on, obviously, but it would be nice if we didn't have to.
Wouldn't it just? So Tanya, you can get off and investigate other issues like this. Tanya, though, briefly, what should people do if they're in this situation?
Well, they can write to us at pensionquestions@thisismoney.co.uk. We do try and sort out cases, but we can't help everyone. It is definitely a good idea to get a hold of your MP as well and ask them to intervene. People have written to us and said that once their MP got involved, it did speed things up for them. And it also has the benefit of raising the issue on the political front. If MPs are aware that lots of their constituents are being affected by this, then they're going to be using their contacts to ask the DWP and their colleagues running it what on earth is going on here. So I think it's definitely worth doing that.
Right, well, we'll put that to bed for now, though I'm sure this story will rumble on. But like many premium bond holders, let's go there. Suzanne Dingle was given hers when she was just a baby. 5 whole British pounds in 1958, which, because I don't just throw this together, I double checked. That's about £97 in today's money. Roll on 65 years, and Susan has never won a penny. And that £5 saved 65 years ago isn't worth £97. It's worth £5. So was Susan right to keep her childhood savings in bonds? Or would it have been wiser to put the cash in a savings account? Simon Lambert, 5 whole British pounds, eh?
5 whole British pounds.
What can you get with that nowadays? Not a lot. Coffee?
Depends where you are, doesn't it? I mean, I would say a pint, but I'm pretty sure I paid £7 for one last night. So this actually does illustrate one of the problems with premium bonds, which is that were you to put your £5 or any other nominal sum of money into a savings account that was paying interest, you would benefit from compounding. So you would get paid some interest. Then you would get paid some interest on the original balance plus the interest. Then you would get paid some interest on the original balance plus the interest, and so on. And over the years, the power of compounding builds up. And there's a really neat trick where between 30 and 40 years, effectively, you double your money. So the compounding effect starts to snowball by so much. Warren Buffett, famous investor, big fan of the snowball concept with compounding, it starts to snowball so much that you get this doubling of your money between 30 and 40 years. And it's why I always say that people should start saving into a pension as soon as they start working, even if it's only £25, £50 a month, because it makes a really big difference if you start then rather than in your mid-30s, for example. Now, I don't imagine for 1 minute that had this £5 been put into a savings account and not added to since 1958, that it would have turned into a life-changing sum of money. The life-changing sum of money that you might get, for example, if you win the premium bonds.
Quite.
But your chance of winning the premium bonds with just £5 in the premium bonds is very, very small, minimal. And in fact, it might be that you have such a small premium bond holding that you don't win at all. You don't end up with the average luck. You end up with below the average luck, even, or even with the average luck, you know, you might not win at all. Statisticians listening to this may be tearing their hair out at the moment, so I'm not going to delve too far into that without actually having the numbers in front of me. And if you don't win at all, then not only do you have no return from your original money, but your original pot doesn't get any bigger in the same way that it would have done had it been in a savings account and compounded, or in an investment. So, for example, had you bought £5 worth of shares and then you had had the gains compound over the years, particularly in the form of dividends paid to you and then reinvested them, then that's where you really, really start to grow your money. There are lots of studies, the Barclays Equity Gilt Study, for example, the Credit Suisse Yearbook, which show the long-term power of investing based on putting your money into the stock market, getting the dividends, and then reinvesting those dividends. So you then hold a slightly bigger investment and then you get more dividends, a slightly bigger dividend investment, and on you go. But yes, £5 saved 65 years ago is still only worth £5. And Susan has astonishingly never won. She is one of 13.4 million premium bond holders who haven't won a prize from their hard-earned savings since May 2004.
I've never won, but then I only started a couple of months ago. So is there an argument then, Simon, that if you've got a really low amount, you know, like a gift from a grandparent or something, really low, it sounds awful, 100 quid, but you know what I mean, that actually you just don't bother unless you're going to really add to it.
Yes. And look, this is quite important. Two-thirds of the 13.4 million savers who haven't won a prize in the past 19 years hold from £1 to £9.
Wow.
And the average sum held by savers who haven't won is £98. Arguably, okay, if you only have a very small amount in the premium bonds, even though that prize rate has gone up from 4% to 4.65%, okay, so the equivalent rate is quite high compared to savings accounts. It's up there in... it's not the best, but it's up there knocking around the best easy access savings accounts. And bear in mind, there's no limit to the amount of withdrawals you can make from the premium bonds each year, unlike many of the best easy access savings accounts. We had one this week, which allows you two withdrawals in 1 year. Okay.
That
at
Paragon?
Which point?
Who's that?
I can't remember Paragon. Which one it is. But
if you take the third one, it goes down to 1.5 or something.
Yeah. You're being gamed here. Right. What you should do is what they're doing is they're getting away with paying you a lower amount than they would pay you on a 1 year fixed rate savings account. And you're effectively going to treat it like a fixed rate savings account. You're not going to take your money out because you don't want to lose the money. So you're being game there with those accounts. So be wary of them. Anyway, premium bonds doesn't do that. You take the money out as much as you want. But if you've got £98 or less, chances are you're going to end up in that bunch of people who aren't going to win. In fact, you need a reasonable amount in there in order to actually start achieving that theoretical average prize rate return. So I would say, in answer to your question, if you have £100 or less in the premium bonds, maybe even if you have £500 or less in the premium bonds, I would say either add to it or maybe put it into a savings account or potentially into an investment account. But you've got to make your own decision on that. And actually, people might have a sentimental attachment to it. It's funny, isn't it? You don't have a sentimental attachment to a savings account. Somebody put some money in a savings account for you when you were born and said, put £100 in that savings account. You wouldn't think, I'm going to have to keep that exact savings account for the rest of my life because otherwise I'm not doing what they wanted me to do. You'd go, okay, well, they want me to have it in the best account. And I've just checked, and that savings account that was opened 65 years ago, turns out it's one of those legacy accounts that pay me 0.01% on. I don't think the person who gave me the money wanted me to earn 0.01%. I think they probably wanted me to earn more. I'll put it in a best savings account. But people will do that with premium bonds. They go, oh, but they wanted me to have it in the premium bonds. I'll keep it in the premium bonds, even if I've never won a penny.
Yeah. Tanya, have you got an emotional connection with premium bonds?
No, I don't. I don't have premium bonds. Yeah, people do love them though, and I understand that it's not something that I feel, but family members have been, you know, really enthusiastic about them and absolutely love them. Taken, you've got to be in it to win it. Approach to the whole thing, and that's fine, I suppose. As well as nostalgia and sentimentality, it's a bit of fun as well, that you could win the big prize. It's not for me, but each to their own.
Yeah. Do you know, in sort of memory of Lee Boyce, who likes the fact that I can multitask while doing this podcast, I don't know if I can, but he always appreciates that. I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll put a couple of hundred quid in my premium bonds, you know, while we're talking. You know, it reminds me to do life and financial admin doing this podcast. It's such an ache. Oh, you put the word you want in front of that. Oh my goodness me, you have to have a link to your phone, and then I can't remember the password, and you've got to have your thing. Can't you just have an app or something? That's the thing that annoys me with premium bonds, is it's just such an effort to top up, Simon.
It can be a bit clunky. I agree. They've tried to improve
clunky,
it. Over,
sorry.
They've tried to improve it over the years. It can be a right pain if you're a parent as well, or a grandparent trying to buy premium bonds for children. My children very kindly were bought premium bonds by my mum, and I ended up in this mad thing of trying to confirm my daughter's existence. They needed with the kind of like a bill with her name on it. I mean, obviously she doesn't have a daughter.
But are you sure you have a daughter? Are you sure, Simon?
Yeah, exactly. It was all a bit mad.
Can't remember.
I was desperately trying to find something that would meet their ID requirements for a 10-year-old girl, which is never the easiest thing to do. It's hard enough when you're an adult in these days of paperless billing and stuff like that. So, yeah. I mean, to go back to what you said about the should you take your money out, I'm going to just quote a couple of experts here that were asked in this story. Andrew Hagger of Moneycoms said, if you've got £100, I would leave it there. Sometimes you might pick a winner. Everyone dreams of the day someone knocks on your door and says you've won the £1 billion jackpot. You're not going to get a lot for £100 in a savings account. That is also a good point, is that you could put your £100 in a savings account, but it's probably only going to end up worth £104.50 at the end of the year. Anna Bose of Savings Champion says it's not worth moving a £100 investment to a top savings account paying 5% for £5 interest a year. So there you go. That's the flip side of what I just said. But if you're actually talking about the return on your money, then you should move it. I mean, it sounds like you're not going to try and move yours, Georgie, because it was hard enough getting your money in there. You don't sound like the kind of person who can face trying to get it out.
Well, I mean, maybe that's next week. Who knows? Who knows what I'll try and do during the podcast next week. But no, it took such an effort to set it up that staying there for a while. Right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Yeah, an interesting one. They always are now. Stock and bond losses continued. Small cap and Chinese stocks really leading those declines due to the rising yields, which we've talked about recently, and obviously oil prices still relatively high. NASDAQ entered a 10% correction. The US 10-year yield reaching 5%. Japanese yen against the US dollar is at 150. Bitcoin at 35,000. Earnings reports were mixed, with Google and Meta beating expectations but selling off. And Microsoft has recently posted a strong quarter three gain. Commodities saw Brent fall below $90, but orange juice is now double its previous all-time high. And also uranium is at its highest since 2011. Elsewhere, Chevron's $53 billion Hess Corporation acquisition accelerated consolidation there. As I mentioned in the crypto market, Bitcoin broke out to 35K, reaching 50% dominance, really driven by optimism of a Bitcoin spot ETF approval, and kind of seen as a bit of a flight to quality at the moment amid this market turbulence. So yeah, an interesting week.
And what do we have coming up next week?
Another busy one. Earnings reports to begin with. Major companies like Apple, AMD, QCOM, McDonald's, Airbnb, Starbucks, Novo Nordisk and HSBC will provide insight into various sectors. Central banks, including the Fed, Bank of England and Bank of Japan, are expected to maintain their current policies, but any hints of change could really influence global markets. Economic data-wise, it's going to be closely watched. We've got the US payrolls next Friday, and focus on the EU, where we're anticipating a negative quarter three GDP figure and a significant drop in inflation. Additionally, just to make things a little bit worse, you've got Halloween and month end on Tuesday, which could make things a little bit more spooky.
Well, I mean, for many investors, October has been a bit of a shocker, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes. Let's get it behind us.
Thanks, Sam. I will catch you next week. Safely in November.
Yes.
Welcome back. Investors have been rattled in recent weeks by a bond market sell-off that has seen prices plummet. Government bond prices have been falling across the US, the UK and Europe for weeks now, over the concern that interest rates will remain elevated for some time to bring inflation back under control. Now, there are also worries about spiralling levels of government debt, particularly in the US. So while opportunities may be created for new buyers, others are left sitting on losses. So, Simon, before we explore what exactly has been going on, a bit of a 101. What are bonds? What is the bond market?
Real bonds, these are. Government bonds are the safest form of investment in theory, especially if you lend to a government that is AAA rated and so is therefore judged to be in the top tier of people who are likely to pay you your money back. And in fact, arguably, if you buy US government bonds or UK government bonds, US bonds are known as treasuries, UK bonds are known as gilts, then you're almost always going to get, you're getting your money back because they're not going to go bust. And one of the reasons why you're getting your money back and they're not going to go bust is both the US and the UK benefit from the ability to create their own money. If the worst comes to the worst, we could just print the money to pay people. I mean, we don't actually print it and hand it to them. We create it, you know, digitally nowadays, but we can just create the money. There are other countries where that's not possible. For example, you know, across the Eurozone, there are countries that don't have the ability to do that. Italy can't just suddenly decide to do that because it's a member of the Eurozone. But the reason why they're judged to be safe is because you lend the government your money. So for example, the UK government, you buy the bond, which involves lending them the money. They then guarantee to pay you back that money at the end of the bond's term, say, for example, in 10 years' time. And they will pay you a rate of interest known as the coupon over those 10 years. And if you buy the bond when it's issued and you hold it to maturity, you know the exact return that you're going to get in the absence of that government going bust. So you know that the £100 you put into that bond, you will get back in 10 years' time. And you know that if that bond pays a rate of 4.5%, you will pick up your 4.5% every year. But bonds are sold on the secondary market as well. And demand for that bond depends on a number of things. A, sentiment, how much do people want to buy bonds at that point in time? And people tend to flock to bonds when they're worried. It's considered a safe asset. There's a lot of money that washes around the world, particularly institutional money, not necessarily individual savers or individual investors' money, but institutional money from fund managers, from very big investors, pension funds, governments even. And it washes into safe bonds when people are worried about stuff because they go, oh, okay, right. And what normally happens is when that happens, the price of those bonds goes up because there's more demand for them. When people are feeling confident, people move more into shares. So that dampens it. But it also depends on the rate of those bonds. And for example, if you look at some of the government bonds that were issued 5 years ago with rates that might be 1%, 2%, they don't look like a very good investment right now when the government bonds being issued now reflect the interest rates that actually exist of like 4.5%, 5%. So people don't want to buy those old bonds. So they trade for below par. And we talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago with individual investors buying short dated UK gilts on the cheap because there's a tax friendly thing, because you know that if you buy them below par, so for example, say you only pay 90p for your £1 worth of bond, if you hold it to maturity, you'll get £1 back. So you have this thing known as yield to maturity. Now, what's been going on in the bond market is that this belief that has taken hold that interest rates are now going to have to stay higher for longer is causing investors to say, I want higher yields on the bonds that I am buying. Otherwise, I am not buying them because I think that interest rates are going to stay high for the next 5 years rather than go up to a point and then come straight back down. When I thought they were going to go up to a point and then come straight back down, I was willing to accept a lower yield on the bond that you were offering me because basically I know that at some point in the future, say, for example, 2.5 years time, interest rates will, I think, be lower than they are now because they're going to go up to a peak and then they're going to come back down. Now they're thinking they're going to go up to a peak and then they're going to plateau for longer. So I want a higher yield on the bond because I think that in 2.5 years time, if I buy this bond, I'm not going to be doing as well as I could be because interest rates are going to be higher. And this feeds through into the financial system and causes all kinds of problems because the risk-free rate of return, i.e. what you can get from just parking your money in a safe government bond, has an effect on what people are willing to pay for shares. Because if you've got a share, for example, that is a growth stock and it promises lots of growth in the future, and you work that out and you go, okay, well, this growth in the future is worth, you know, kind of X to me. You also go, well, what's that compared to? This is what big institutional investors do. What's that compared to? You know, I'm not comparing that to zero. I'm comparing it to what I could get guaranteed risk-free rate of return. And if I can get 5% on a 10-year US government bond, then that return from that stock is going to need to be 5% a year plus what I think it's worth compensating me for the risk that actually that company might go bust, it might not make those profits, and it might not do as well. And if it's a kind of growth stock where it's very much jammed tomorrow, those profits are promised in the future, they're a lot less certain. So you're going to want a higher rate of return in order to reward you for doing that. Now, go back a couple of years when interest rates were super low, returns were rubbish elsewhere, there is no alternative. People were falling over themselves to pay high multiples for growth companies because, you know, that was the only place they were going to make these returns. Now you've got companies like oil giants, for example, BP, Shell, making money hand over fist, handing out dividends to their shareholders. And you can see those profits right now. So people are a bit more attracted to the profits that you can see now because they can more easily compare them to the 5% they're going to get on a government bond. But even with companies that pay a dividend, for example, when interest rates were 0.5%, a company paying a 4%, 4.5% dividend looked absolutely great because it's like, well, that is a much, much better return. The dividend could always be cut, but, you know, I can look at this, like it's got decent dividend cover. It's got a decent business model. I think this is a reasonable stock to buy. And I'm going to be getting way more than I would get in an interest rate return or off government bonds. But if you've got government bonds paying you 5% or 4.5%, do you really want that stock that pays a 4.5% dividend, but probably isn't really ever going to grow its share price? Well, no, it doesn't look so attractive. So this is where the trouble comes in. And what we're seeing is the unwinding of the super low interest rate world and the sort of ructions of it. And every so often we have this sort of periodic plot line that reoccurs in the soap opera of the investment world where everyone has a bit of a freak out about bond yields. And that plot line has been running through the markets over the last month or so. I mean, whether they will come up with a different twist at the end of it, we don't know yet. We have to just keep watching the show and find out. But it is unnerving for investors who then obviously decide that things are a bit worrying and they're going to flock to safety. And that causes a bit more of a problem.
Well, Tanya, I want to sort of, Simon's explained that beautifully there, but the sort of bigger picture, the so what? What does this, who does this impact? How does this impact the economy, pension savers? What's the impact of this?
It does affect you if you're investing or you've got pension savings, for the reasons that Simon explained about the impact on the stock market. We're always told that we need to have a balanced portfolio. And if you followed that advice, you're going to have shares and you're going to have bonds as well. The trouble is that you need to keep quite a good eye on what might happen with interest rates to keep on top of this. You know, if you're a hobbyist investor, then you quite like keeping an eye on all this kind of thing. But what's going on with sentiment at the moment is that really the kind of things you're going to have to keep an eye on is US GDP figures came out this week. It was 4.9% on an annualized basis. And that means that that adds to the worry that interest rates are going to stay higher for longer. Oil prices are also up, which means because of the awful conflict that's going on in the Middle East. And that feeds into inflation, you know, fears as well. So that adds to the worry that interest rates are going to have to stay higher for longer. So if you're an ordinary investor, it is a good idea to keep an eye on all of this, just so that you know which way it might be heading. It's a bit more tricky for pension savers because they are putting money away for the long term. And we know from all the research that they don't really take a lot of interest, most of them, in where they're invested and what's going on with their money. And there is a really nasty trap that some people have fallen into, especially with older style pension funds, because as you approach retirement, something like called lifestyling kicks in, where you're gradually moved out of stocks and into bonds. And that's on the basis, the assumption still, that you are going to buy an annuity at the end of it. So therefore you want to keep your money as safe as possible. Now, a lot of people don't buy annuities anymore. They might want to invest for another 30 years. So there's a big debate to be had about whether it's worth doing any lifestyling at all. So if you are approaching retirement and you get a letter about whether you want to be lifestyled or not, then don't just put that in the bin. Have a good look at that, because you don't want to be caught out. What's happening at the moment is that because of the trouble in the bond market, a lot of these people are now sitting on losses and their fund is a lot less than they expected, which is incredibly worrying for them. There is something you can do about that, though, because annuity rates have improved with interest rates going up. Annuity rates have improved. And a lot of people don't like the idea of annuities, but you really need to take a really good look at them again, because in a way the system's kicked in as it should have done, because annuity rates have gone up, which would hopefully compensate you to some extent for the losses, you know, the smaller fund that you've now got, because you can get a bigger annuity. But this is one of the things that people who have just had a pension fund that they've just put money into all these years and not taken a lot of interest in, suddenly have to grapple with. Last year, when there was quite a big bond wobble, Steve got quite a lot of questions into his inbox from people who were very worried about sudden huge drops in their pension fund. And we're starting to get those emails again now, unsurprisingly. So yeah, hopefully that gives you some idea about how crucial it might end up being to an individual.
Thank you for that, Tanya. Right then, finally, because we do love a good neighbourly dispute on the podcast, read a question time. Our next door neighbour, not me, has recently decided to install a smart doorbell next to his front door. Now, we live in a semi-detached house and his front door is right next to ours. So it means every time we leave and enter our home, he could be watching or listening to us. I've put the emphasis here, by the way, for dramatic effect. He has also installed what essentially looks like CCTV cameras in his back garden. I'm not sure what else they could be, but you never know. Bird watching things. Anyway, I assume to ward off potential burglars. No, I think it's so that he can look into your garden. Anyway, it's quite clear that both cameras are high enough to see into our garden and potentially even our kitchen, which looks out over the garden. We feel these cameras are compromising our privacy. Do we have a right to complain? And can we legally force him to remove or move the cameras if push comes to shove? Simon, obviously, I was jesting there. It's a bit disconcerting, isn't it, with all these cameras about, could you just go next door and say, look, do you mind just pointing it in a slightly different direction? Are they even on? Or perhaps people are just a bit paranoid. Didn't we have one about fences recently, worried that their neighbours were looking over the fence? You know what? Maybe they're not. Maybe they're not looking at you and they don't care what you're doing in your kitchen. That's also a consideration.
This is very true. Mm. This is very true.
Yeah.
It is a modern thing, though, these security cameras, Ring doorbells, other makes of video doorbell. Lots of people have them. There is a proliferation of them. They are spreading as well. I mean, I am aware of, you know, many of them around where I live. I'm aware that whenever something happens in the neighborhood WhatsApp group, people will be like, oh, I've got this on my Ring doorbell. It's a way of checking up on the security of things. I also know people who have, you know, had one and they've had their car stolen, for example, and all they could do was see someone stealing their car. But it's fine, I guess, out the front of your house when it's looking at the street or at the front of your or just at the front of the house that it's on. But people do start to get a bit unhappy about when they think that it is pointing at their garden or pointing into their house, and people expect their privacy. And I guess the difference between this and the fence question we had the other week, where someone was thinking that they wanted to put up a high fence to stop the people in the flats behind being able to see into their garden, is that that's a momentary thing, isn't it? The people in the flats seeing into your garden, you're in your garden, they're there, they walk past, they can see you, they're gone, you know, or they're sitting on their balcony or whatever. If they were on their balcony filming into your garden all the time, you might start to feel a bit more unnerved by it.
Yeah, but you know what? I bet you, but if a burglar comes to your house, you'll be damn grateful for that neighbour having a camera pointed in that direction, no?
Well, you might be, but I'm a bit dubious about actually how good cameras are. And I see quite a lot of footage on news websites of people robbing cars, bikes, houses that has been captured on these cameras. And the people do these things where they put a balaclava on or something like that. So it's like, has this actually achieved anything? You know, I suppose potentially if the police catch them, if might be doing quite a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence, mightn't it?
Well, at least you know it was stolen rather than you left it somewhere.
It wouldn't be somebody sitting on their balcony permanently filming into their garden. It wouldn't be an active thing. It's a passive thing. Cameras sitting there passively. And the Information Commissioner's Office has some sort of guidelines on this. But I guess one thing to point out, you know, as Ed points out in this article, is that most of the time people aren't actually just sitting there and watching that footage. You know, most of the time it will just be recording. They will never, ever look at it. They will only look at it if something's gone wrong. And if it's just filming your garden, and actually most of the time you won't even be in your garden, or you won't be probably won't be filming the whole of your garden. It will be like one little corner of your garden that it can see in the corner of the shot. And you probably don't even spend any time in that bit of your garden. I guess the thing is, though, is that you don't know without asking your neighbour what they can or can't see. It might be that they can see into your kitchen. It might be that when you're wandering around in your kitchen late at night or early in the morning with no clothes on, that actually your neighbours can see that and they have got it on film. And you might decide that you don't want that. Or you might decide that that's their own problem and really you couldn't care less. Or you know, other things like that. The easy thing to do, in theory, is to go to your neighbour and say, I see you put that camera up. You're obviously concerned about security. And I mean, it's good. It acts potentially as a deterrent. And hopefully if something does happen, it would enable the person who did something to be caught. But I'm slightly concerned that you might be able to see into my garden, into my kitchen, you know, something like that. Would you mind showing me what the camera actually shows? And then you can understand it and you can know that you can safely wander around your kitchen in your pants if you want to, or sit in your garden doing whatever you want to do. Because you know that they can't actually see in. Or you could say, actually, do you know what? I'm a bit concerned because you've just shown me that you can basically see into my kitchen all the time, or you can see into my garden all the time. And I don't really like that. Do you think you could just angle it slightly? being British, I can't see that many of us doing that and going around to our neighbours and asking.
No.
I can see us telling our friends about this is money.
Writing into this is money.
And you know, we get a great Ask an Expert question out of it. But the Information Commissioner's Office, which oversees and enforces data protection law, states the use of recording equipment such as CCTV or smart doorbells to capture video or sound recordings outside the user's property boundary is not a breach of data protection law. People should try to point their CCTV cameras away from their neighbours' homes and gardens, shared spaces or public streets, but this is not always possible. When people capture images and audio recordings outside of their property boundary, they should consider how intrusive this activity is. They should consider whether they can point their cameras elsewhere, or if possible, apply filters or privacy blocks. In these circumstances, data protection law also requires them to follow certain rules, although these are difficult to enforce.
Sorry, Simon, just a daft one. If you had a camera pointed at someone's bedroom over the road, that would come under something else? I mean, surely that can't be allowed?
I don't know. I mean, there would obviously be a definite...
Might be a stalking thing going on there.
If you had a camera pointed at your neighbour over the road's bedroom window, I think that there would be definite grounds for complaint. And I'm pretty sure, right, even though they're quite busy, that if somebody went to the police, obviously you speak to your neighbour first, but if somebody went to the police and said, look, my neighbour over the road's got a camera pointed directly at my bedroom window, they're not actually filming anything else, they can't see the ground, they can't see anything, I don't think my bedroom window is a major security risk to them. Do you think you could have a word? I'm pretty sure somebody might go around and say to them,
yeah,
what do you think you do in sunshine?
Yeah, fair.
You know, so the use of CCTV cameras, according to a lawyer that we spoke to, Olivia Edgar Page of Joseph A. Jones and Co. Solicitors, said the use of CCTV cameras by a neighbour could, depending on the circumstances, be challenged under the Protection from Harassment Act 1997, which provides that a person must not pursue a course of conduct which amounts to harassment of another and which he knows or ought to know amounts to harassment. Pretty sure that if you just set up a camera filming your neighbour over the road or your next door neighbour's bedroom, you might fall foul of that one.
I think so. I've sort of got a quite a clear view of this. You know, if my bedrooms go out onto, or anything goes out onto the street with the general public, then for the good of the general public, I've got blinds and I'll keep them up. But for the rest, I think, I'm quite happy. Maybe this is a Nordic sensibility I have. I don't mind walking around in my pants. If you want to look in my backyard, bad luck to you, I think. Tanya, you recommended blinds. You've got them behind you. You know, there are solutions here, but just me sort of you having to be proactive as opposed to neighbours looking over your fence or through cameras at you.
Well, I don't think having curtains or shutters or blinds is a massive imposition. I mean, most people have them. So that's... that seems to be a fairly straightforward way of sorting it out. Are net curtains in or out at the moment? Have they come back in fashion?
Oh, no.
Net curtains. Surely there must be some modern version of the net curtain that is really
trendy. You can put some frosting on your glass.
Yes, that is very popular around here, actually, to have the lower half of windows frosted. So I guess there are ways to cover your windows and still be able to see out, but other people can't see in.
Or just live and let live. You know, I kind of just think this is the modern day. We're trying to build more houses. You know, some of us have houses which are a little bit closer to others. But if you have any issues, do get in contact. Thank you very much, Tanya. Thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up to date with the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, except your garden, Simon.
Or if you would like us to come and look in your garden, you can also email us. We cannot, just to say though, like, we cannot help every reader with their problems. We do our best. We can't promise that we will come around and look in all of your gardens. If we get deluged with requests, we're just gonna have to say sorry. We can only be in one place at a time,
right?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments and tell us what your view is on looking into your neighbours' gardens windows or other parts of their house or them looking into yours.
Do. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.